this is a spoiler.
You can't listen to this and not have spoilers.
I guess I threw a curveball this time a little bit in doing a novel and a short story, but it's really more of a novella. So we've got The Hour of the Star by Clarice Lispector and The Departure of the Train by the same author. And The Hour of the Star, it's a weird story about a girl, and the narrator himself is a part of the story, talking about a girl who is a sort of very special kind of girl, in that she's not special. It's full of contradictions. She's poor. She's very poor, and she's also very naive. And he gives just a brief little tour through her life, and it's more of a sort of phenomenological tour through her life. And there aren't a lot of events in the story. I mean, there are a few. She has a boyfriend. She has a job that she gets fired from. Her boyfriend dumps her, and she goes to a fortune teller and has a revelation there. And then on the way out of the fortune teller, she gets hit by a car and is killed. And there's not really a lot more to the novel beyond that. The charm of it, I think, is really all in the form. There's a lot of pathos and sensuality and a voice. And that, to me, was the most distinctive thing about it, is this author's prose, her voice. It's got this very specific sort of excessive quality. And it was definitely present in the short story as well, The Departure of the Train. That one's about a couple of women who are on the train. One of them is older, Donna Maria, your woman, Angela, I think it is. And Lispector kind of juxtaposes their two lives and their streams of consciousness while on this train. And she gets just sort of some interesting dynamics about life and the different possibilities of regarding life and the situations in one's life and subjectivity. And again, that very specific sort of voice is there. And it's interesting because it's at once very self-conscious. The narration is self-conscious. The writing is self-conscious. The characters are self-conscious. But at the same time, the voice never really lapses. It's still so specific. So you get an interesting paradox there, I think. But also in The Departure of the Train, there's not really a lot in the way of events. It's more of sort of what's going on within these two women's minds and why they are both on this train for different reasons. Donna Maria is on her way to see one of her children, and Angela is running away from a husband. And she has different reasons for that, which we can get into. And she's going to live on her uncle's farm. But yeah, it's really all about the right and what's going on it, and sort of trying to figure out what it means for these two, all of the characters in these books, to be who they are and to be live, and how we should think about them and how they should think about themselves and their situations. And poverty is a big theme in The Hour of the Star. And she sort of walks around the subject of poverty and looks at it from different angles and gives you different takes on it and raises some interesting questions, which maybe we can get into.
Yeah, well, let me, I did not read the short story. I read the novella.
Okay.
So maybe start with a short story and then, or maybe, things can tie in, but I'd like to hear more about the short story. I mean, I love the novella and I'm itching to get to it.
Yeah, I thought that the short story was interesting because I thought that they were both going back to, they were both leaving situations that were unbearable. That Doña Maria? Because okay. Her daughter is so cold, and Angela, because her, I don't think they were married. I think he was her boyfriend.
Mm.
But not that it matters.
Yeah, boyfriend.
He was coldly all mind. And she always felt like she was lacking in his eyes because she wasn't the intellectual giant that he was. And she didn't want to be. And I think that she was lacking in her own eyes because of that, because she wanted to read Reader's Digest instead of James Joyce all the time. And I thought that it was interesting that they were both going back to situations where they were loved. The son that the mother was going to live with loved her in the very innocent you're my mother and I love you. He wasn't a, you know, he was a farmer, and Angela was going to live with her uncles and they were on a farm. And I think that they were going back to some simpler sense of love or some simpler relationships, some simpler love relationships than the ones that they had developed, because the daughter, Doña Maria, her daughter was all work and she was an attorney. And I think that she thought that her mother was maybe frivolous and, you know, in her, maybe she thought she was a little bit ridiculous, like, the, you know, this ridiculous, sentimental old woman. So yeah, I thought that that was interesting that they were both running away from the coldness to something that would be much warmer. They would be going back to these people who love them in a much warmer way.
That's right. It says at one point in that story, both women were going to be received with open arms, but neither good of the other, which didn't occur to me entirely until you said it that way. But that was part of the juxtaposition of the two of them, is that they had things in common, they had differences. And then, you know, I mean, maybe these are all sort of bound in the human experience. I mean, they're all ways it can go.
Yeah, and they're both women living for other people too, right? Like, their identities are very much wrapped up in the people they associate with rather than themselves.
What made you choose this short story, Daniel?
The story was what I read first, and I didn't know much about the novella going in, but I was looking, been reading a lot of Fernando Pessoa, and he's become one of my favorite authors, and I was looking around for authors like him, and I stumbled on her, and I don't know, I can see some similarities there, but she's her own sort of animal, and as soon as I read the story, I mean, it was like four or five sentences in, and I fell in love.
Right.
Right, where it says, well-dressed elderly lady with jewels. From the wrinkles that masked her came the pure form of a nose lost in age and of a mouth that once must have been full and sensitive. But what does it matter? Right. And right when she says, but what does it matter? I knew, like, okay, well, this is
interesting. Voice.
Beautiful voice. Beautiful writing.
I don't mean to jump ahead, but to the novella, I mean, the first line, I had that same thing. It was like, oh, this is an original voice. Okay.
The preface and the first line, reading the preface and then reading the first line knocked me out. I stopped. And I think I wrote to you guys.
You'd mentioned the novella is hugely about form, and it is very much like a master almost showing off, a kind of look what I can do, and how she puts the story in another author's voice. And the story's almost the narrator teasing you as far as what they can do with their literary talents and the sort of broad brushstrokes that they paint you. And
you're talking about the novella, right?
The novella, yes. I'd read both of them.
No, I know, but I'm saying you read the novella first.
I read the novella first and then the story. Yeah.
And how did that affect you? Just out of curiosity.
Well, I was confused in the sense that there's that email chain going around about how she's very much like Virginia Woolf, and I couldn't make that connection from the novella. But as soon as I read the short story, I'm like, oh yes, very much so, you know, very introspective, phenomenological story. But with the novella, to me, was closer than like a Pale Fire type story, with how it's couched with the other thing and how it's very introspective as far as what it's doing and the art of writing itself. And this, you know, the narrator's hold over you, his power, his teasing you with, you know, I think he even teases you with that release at some point. He says how easily he could kill this character, but he won't do that.
Well, he strings you along for a long time before telling you anything factual, and very consciously so. Like, I'm going to, you know, first I'm just going to talk about all these feelings, and then I'm going to tell you something about what really happens. And that's fun.
Sure, I felt like the story could be, you know, the ugly duckling, but it was just an ugly duckling and then it died. There, you know, that's...
Yeah. Yeah. I had a hard time imagining a man as the narrator. I couldn't get her, Clarice Lispector. Someone had sent a story about her, and I clicked on it and looked at the image of her, and that picture was in my head the whole time. And I was like, I had to keep reminding myself that it's supposed to be a male voice narrating.
Yeah, the tyranny of images, right? She's incredibly beautiful in the that New Yorker shot. So
yeah, I think
that was a problem for me as well, as far as imagining that male narrator.
Yeah,
that's right. And as the narrator is playing with the reader about the contingencies of creating Maccabea, who's the girl in the story. I don't think I said her name. As he's teasing the reader with the contingencies of what he can do with her story, you can feel, I felt Lispector teasing with him in the same sort of way. Like, her voice is there behind his, and at times what he might do or the way he might describe things as well seemed like winking at you to say that, you know, she can pull his strings in the same way that he can pull Pool of Maccabeas. But interestingly, I felt like that it was teasing, but it wasn't just purposeless teasing, you know, to play with form only for the sake of a sort of empty avant-garde experimentalism. But she really wanted to get to the bottom of this self-creation that we all experience on a daily basis and what it means to be in control of how we manifest who we are and what trying to investigate through introspection who we are, you know, what can we come up with and how can we experience any truth in that process and what counts as truth. And she's exploring this in a very chaotic way because the prose is very abrupt. One of the things I loved about both of the stories was that just never knew what was going to happen in the next sentence.
How do you mean that in the sense that I think, are we going to go with Maccabea? Is that what we're going to go with? Because I also don't understand her name. Yeah. Because I feel like as a character, if you take her alone, she wasn't introspective at all, right? She was kind of going with the flow. It was that narrator that created her. And it was interesting how different that was than the full and alive characters that were in the short story.
Yeah, I think you're getting at the crux of the novel. I think investigating that and what it is about her that is important or is worth looking at, that's the question of it. And that's what the narrator, I think, is trying to figure out too, because like I alluded to, it's in many ways, I think it's a story about poverty and they both have a kind of poverty and she's comparing these two sorts of poverty. And we can examine in what ways Rodrigo, who's the narrator, and Maccabea, in what ways they're impoverished.
Yeah, there's a little bit of like a fault going on from read before where he's giving you this kind of narrative with like a trick to it. I feel like the one for the narrator is that he mentions that reading is a luxury and that the wealthy man will enjoy this, but the poor man won't bother because they got more important things to do and they're hungry. I found that line, Cesari. It was, since Maccabea for now is adrift in chaos like a door swinging in an infinite wind, I could wrap it up taking the easiest route, killing the infant girl. But I want the worst thing of all, life. So let those who read me get punched in the stomach to see if it's good. Life is a punch in the stomach. This is a rich book, and I'm going to have to go back and read it again. It feels like a masterpiece. Someone else said that. But I mean, it seems like someone saw a girl and there's a lot of deep empathy. But there was also explosions bracketed. And whenever I went back and read the preface, it was written in the time of like an emergency or maybe some kind of Civil War disaster or something. I don't know. I'm trying to figure out like what the context of everything is. Does anyone know what the explosions were? That's one of my questions.
I have a theory about it. But
For some reason, I thought they were fireworks. But I have a line about, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think it was a knocking down of the fourth wall comment of the experience that the character was having at that moment.
Mm. Oh, interesting.
Because the fourth wall is knocked down constantly through this story.
That's right. It's very much like a Brecht play, you know?
Very much.
You see all the strings being pulled. You see the author just sort of mentioning that, you know, this could go this way or this could go that way. Or, you know, how am I feeling right now as I'm writing this story? Well, I need to take a little break. It's getting to me. You know, should this happen yet or should it happen later? I don't know. But one thing I just quickly wanted to say is that maybe it seems like maybe it's going to be impossible for us to stick to one. So maybe we should just go back and forth, because I think one thing that relates both of the stories is that we've got two characters who are juxtaposed against each other. And so maybe we can just juxtapose all of them in some way.
I wanted to read this about the self-consciousness and the not revealing things from the get-go. And he says this parenthetically, I think on page 30. If I'm delaying making the things happen that I already vaguely foresee, it's because I need to take a few snapshots of the girl from Alagoa. And also because if there's any reader for this story, I'd like him to absorb this girl like a cloth soaking up water. The girl is a truth I don't want to know about. I don't know whom to accuse, but somebody has to have done it. When I was reading that, I thought, okay, this is a snapshot of if you just told the story of the girl before you put in all of that introspective pathos of the narrator, then it would have been a very different story.
Yeah, I mean, and the narrator is the only one that sees this girl. I mean, really. I mean, even though she has like a presence in the world, I mean, people forget that she's there and, you know, visible and says often that I alone love her and, you know, calls her like a biblical figure that is just timeless and compares her. There's a good line in there, something that she's just the grass. She's just like kind of like a background thing, primal or primeval or something, really essential thing. And, you know, has maybe been before and will be again, you know, just this instance, but uniquely in her situation, she encapsulates I mean, it's poverty, yeah, but I mean, her character is very interesting. And also, I mean, you don't know if this is her character, right? It's also at some point the imagination of the narrator who is openly questioning the imagination they're having of things that they couldn't know but by imagining and maybe guess at it correctly.
Well, I like that you say that she's a biblical character and her boyfriend who treats her like shit is Jesus or Jesus. Yeah. Like, yeah, not even Jesus could be Jesus. Nice to this girl.
That the boyfriend, his name is, I thought this was interesting, Jesus, because that's the name that you give orphans or bastards. You know, it's like it's a placeholder for a dignified name. And they both come from this like Badlands and have their own reasons for being cruel. Olympico, the boyfriend, killed a man, and that's his secret.
I got from her this driving at this like, deeply human essence, because, I mean, as a character, and I'm not sure how much this is tied into her being a woman, but in all these poverty or coming-of-age stories, there's always this quality that's supposed to save the character for you, you know? So you're reading the story, and now you imagine that Masabe is beautiful, but she's not. Or you imagine that all this is happening to her, but she's interesting, and we'll get out that way, but she's really not. She's not interesting. She's not intelligent. She's not particularly smart or, you know, pretty and all these things. And yet, you know, when she's dying in the street, you have real deep empathy for her. So the fact that he can get at that connects us with some aspect of humanity that goes beyond just looking at a quality we find endearing in people.
Yeah, well, I mean, she's a Hercules for taking shit. I mean, she, right? I mean, like her
wife is cleaning the stables.
yeah, exactly. Diverting that river. You know, I mean, from the beginning, you know, it's that she wants to take a step forward. And that's what makes it so cruel at the end with the fortune teller is that, you know, she, for the first time, sees her life as someone else as like, oh my God, you've had it so bad. Like no one's ever empathized with her that way.
Well, I think that's why she was hit by the car then, because she'd started to believe, started to have hope.
Yeah, that was a big part of the story, you're right, is that she didn't realize, it's not that she was suffering throughout the novel, it's that she didn't even realize what was happening, right?
Right.
It's very important because I think, I mean, the narrator can't stop tripping over himself to tell us how pathetic this girl is. He tells us all of these pathetic details and how stupid she is, how useless she is. She can't figure anything out. She doesn't have any talents. She doesn't have any beauty. She doesn't have any skills. And yet he can't, that's like, the question is like, why then can he not bring himself to just be done with her, to dismiss her? But there's something that draws him to her and sort of breaks his heart, and he's trying to figure out what it is. And I think that what he sees is this kind of wholeness that comes from a lack of self-consciousness. She doesn't know that her life is pathetic. She doesn't see herself as pathetic. She doesn't wonder what else her life might be. She doesn't, it doesn't hurt her. She has a kind of innocence and naivete that makes her impervious to the violence of ideas and thoughts. And that's something that as a writer, he doesn't have at all. Her poverty is to have none of life's succulent things, you know.
I don't think her poverty is a materialistic thing. I think her poverty is emotional and philosophical inside of her. That's what her poverty is, and maybe that's what he admires.
I mean, she lost her parents when she was very young, and that's another thing that I think would make us all sympathetic, was that her aunt who took her in was so immensely cruel. She was not just cruel, she was sadistic, really abused her. And I think that's part of it. I mean, it was worse than that. I mean, she didn't feed her, for Christ's sake. She was just this skinny little thing, and she punished her all the time. She had no toys.
Off of her too.
Well, I think there's that idea that if you beat down an animal's going to be beat down. You know, children that don't get any love at all. And then maybe she actually had a little bit of love, and then her parents died. They don't say much about her parent. He doesn't say much about her parents, but the aunt cruelty, I think, is part of the, you know, is a big part of the sympathy. Is that you look at this girl and you say, how did she get this way? And you get that way when people treat you like shit. Like when you're a child, the horrible upbringing.
I think it's all she's ever known too, right? Because her boss didn't treat her much better, nor did Gloria or her boyfriend, right?
Yeah, but there's more to it than that, I think, because many people can experience cruelty. I mean, take Olympico, for instance. I mean, I think he was someone who experienced cruelty and it made him cruel. And he had this outside looking in on himself sort of quality where he was always seeing himself through other people's eyes. And that was what made him ambitious, and it made made him strive to become this objective thing that would have then an effect on the other people who he wanted to see himself in a certain way through. But she doesn't play any of those mind games. She's sort of pure in that way.
Well, she's pure because she doesn't know. If you don't know the other, you can't know what you are.
But what about that time that she saw a man who was so beautiful that she had to take the next day off work? I'm sorry, I loved that.
Oh man,
I'm so taken with
that's
your
beauty. Great. That's great.
Day off and have the apartment to myself, which I thought was just great, like, yeah. This is the only time in her life she's ever actually like planned out masturbation or something like that.
Doesn't the narrator even say something at that point? Like, wait a minute, this is a surprise to me too that she would have a moment like this.
Yeah. I thought that that meant that she did have an idea. She did get ideas of hope and of love. And she had inklings when she was a child. Didn't he say that she would pretend that she had a doll that she would run down the hall with
something? No, it's more sinister than that. She did pretend, but it's one of the lines I've written down. It's that she was trying to pretend that she had dolls, and it was such a twisted version of it because it was a bitter remembrance of something that she didn't have, and it was just the saddest thing you've ever seen. Yeah, I mean, she was playing with the doll, and it was just pitiful.
You know, I want to step in here, sorry Nathan, and read something from the Guardian about this, a secondary source. In October 1977, shortly before her death, she published the novella The Hour of the Star, in which all her talents and eccentricities merged and folded in a densely self-conscious narrative dealing with the difficulty and odd pleasures of storytelling, and then proceeding, when it could, to tell the story of Maccabea, a woman who, Le Spectre told an interviewer, was so poor that all she ate were hot dogs. But she made clear that this was not the story, though. The story is about a crushed innocence, about an anonymous misery. The story is also about a woman from the state of Alagoa in the northeast of Brazil. The Le Spectres first lived there when they came to the country, who then goes to live in Rio de Janeiro, as Clarice did. In a scene towards the end of the book, the heroine goes to a fortune teller, Madame Carlotta, just as Le Spectre herself went to a fortune teller. Le Spectre told a TV interviewer, "I went to a fortune teller who told me about all kinds of good things that were about to happen to me. And on the way home in the taxi, I thought it would be really funny if a taxi hit me and ran me over and I died after hearing all those good things." This is not to suggest that the story is autobiographical. Rather, it is an exploration of a self that is sometimes glimpsed but barely known. At the time when Le Spectre was writing the book, she was herself glimpsed by the writer Jose Castello on Avenida Copacabana in Rio, looking into a shop window. When he greeted her, he wrote, "It takes her a while to turn around. She doesn't move at first, but then, for I dare repeat the greeting, she turns slowly, as if to see where something frightening had come from, and says, 'So it's you.' At that moment," Jose Castello says, "he was horrified. He noticed that there was nothing in the shop window that she was looking at but undressed mannequins. But then my silly horror becomes a conclusion. Clarice had a passion for the void." I think I sent you guys something about that, right? Mm-hmm. That was titled The Passion for the Void. And that made me think of Virginia Woolf too. But it is kind of like that this novella, I guess the short story, but more the novella, the way it's written in the voice that is coming out from her is bringing out that void. It's kind of like trying to give form to formlessness. Mm-hmm. So it's trying to do that, but you can't give form to formlessness. But mm-hmm. She kind of does that, or tries to do that.
I just wanted to mention, from what you said as far as the story being of crushing innocence, the only way I could connect the novella and the short story was along the lines of how knowledge can be crushing, and how Maccabea kind of lived on another plane that was different from the other characters, how her boyfriend was just as pathetic as she was, but came into this knowledge that let him structure the world in hierarchical terms where he wanted to be on top. And obviously, no one bought reading that he would achieve the grand things he claimed. But Maccabea didn't even talk or didn't think of the world in those terms, in hierarchical terms, because of the knowledge he lacked. And the way it connects that the short story is the same sense how one of the women were fleeing their partners for almost his abusive knowledge, right?
Well, it's funny because I certainly see that passion for the void and the desire to give form to formlessness and to portray in words, a kind of emptiness. That's what the narrator is troubled with. I mean, if we talked about sort of some of Maccabeus' poverty, I think some of Rodrigo's poverty is what he talks about in the beginning. I think I even have some of it here. He's looking inside himself and feels that, you know, there's an emptiness inside of him. And he says, one way of getting is not looking. One way of having is not asking and only believing. The silence I believe to be inside me is the answer to my mystery. And so he feels like, I think I identified his poverty with a subjectivity that when it investigates itself can find no foundation, just finds silence, finds nothing objective within itself. And words are his way of objectifying himself. He writes himself and the world into existence. And in some way, that's a kind of control, but at the same time, it's paradoxical.
Do you mean in his Verdaccio or how he
Rodrigo?
Yeah.
In telling the whole story, I think it's as if there's contingency there until the words are down. There's a conflation throughout the entire novella of thoughts, acts, feelings, and facts. Throughout the whole thing, all of those are conflated with each other, and it's not clear where one ends and one begins. One of the things that drew me to this right away was, you know, you have that void, but you also have this very excessive, full, passionate quality. And I think that's all over the short story, especially, but even the novella, I mean, right at the beginning, he says, as long as I have questions and no answers, I'll keep on writing. How do you start at the beginning if things happen before they happen? If before prehistory, there were already apocalyptic monsters. If this story doesn't exist, now it will. Thinking is an act. Feeling is a fact. Put the two together. I am the one writing what I am writing. God is the world. Truth is always an interior and inexplicable contract. My life is truest. My truest life is unrecognizable, extremely interior. And there is not a single word that defines it. My heart has emptied itself of every desire and has been reduced to its own final or primary beat.
I got to read this now that you said that. You were quoting from the preface?
That was from the first page of The Hour of the Star.
Right. This is a quote that I saw because I was reading a lot of secondary sources as well, because this woman just amazingly fascinates me, as I'm sure she fascinates all of us. And I saw this quote from Helen Cissoir, who is a French critic of Le Spectre's, but also a friend of hers. And she said something that's really fascinating to me. If Kafka were a woman, if Rilke were a Brazilian Jewish woman born in the Ukraine, if Rambo had been a mother, if he had reached his 50s, if Heidegger had been able to stop being German, if he had written the novel of the Earth, it's in this ambience that Clarice Lispector writes. There, where the most demanding works breathe, she advances. There, further ahead, where the philosopher loses his breath, she continues still further beyond all knowledge. That struck me when you said that. That, to me, points to her essence.
I like that comparison of Heidegger, because I think all our characters struggle with being, certainly, with what it means to be a human being.
Absolutely. It's fascinating. And when I see that picture of her from the New Yorker, right? You mentioned that, right, Cesare? Mm-hmm. Didn't you? I just, mm-hmm. I look at her and I'm like, how did this come out of her? To be totally stereotypical and say, yes, this is the woman of a Brazilian diplomat who was, you know, giving fancy parties to all the politicians in D.C. in the 50s. Look at her and say, oh, yeah, yeah. Not when you hear the voice in these stories. Anyway, I'm going off. But it just fascinates me, that dichotomy of, maybe even that's what she's bringing up in her writing, that dichotomy of what you see and what really you don't see.
Yeah, that I think, I mean, just going back to Maccabeus, I mean, that's her whole thing, is that she doesn't really have anything at all. And so she just tries to enjoy what she can by taking in the time around her, you know, by slowing things down, and just kind of like in Catch 22, where he like takes all the bad jobs so that time goes slow and he's less likely to, he can enjoy more time between deployments where he might die. But by, you know, scrubbing the toilets, he has more life. So she just takes everything and stretches it out, lets the outside world become her solace, or the thing that she doesn't even think to live. It's just today and right now and this next moment.
Yeah, maybe both stories have that, because they both have, I guess, that Maccabeus listened to the clock radio and liked to hear the tick tock, tick tock. And Angela liked to walk in that crazy fruit that, before you guys came on, Daniel and I were talking about the fruit from the tree that she would walk through and it would make a clock, clock, clock sound. And there was this regular rhythm. There was a sound that gave them both comfort. I'm going to put a link in so you guys can look at the pictures on the Wikipedia page of the crazy tree she's talking about, the fruit from this tree. The fruit grows basically on the bark. I have never seen anything like this in my life. I was like, how have I lived this long and never seen this insane tree?
Well, in that image, it's so great because it points to the other thing about this novel, which I definitely don't want us to leave out, or this writer that I don't want us to leave out, which is that The Hour of the Star is very intellectual. It's very heady, but I don't think I've ever read anyone who wrote this sensuous, with this sensuous quality that she writes with. I mean, The Departure of the Train especially has this sensual quality and this bursting excessive passion in these. Here's one little passage where Angela is talking about Eduardo, her boyfriend, and why she's leaving him. She says, "Unhappiness is the only certainty. I'm not going to fall for that, Eduardo. I want to savor everything and then die, and may I be damned, damned, damned. The old woman may, in fact, be unhappy without knowing it. Passivity. I'm not going to fall for that either. No passivity for me. I want to bathe naked in the muddy river that looks like me, naked and free. Viva. Three vivas. I'm leaving everything behind, everything, and therefore I am not abandoned. I don't want to depend on anyone but some three people. As for the rest, hello. How are you? Okay, Edu, you know, I'm leaving you. You and the depths of your intellectualism aren't worth the life of a dog. I'm leaving you then, and I'm leaving the pseudo-intellectual group that demanded of me an unending and vain and nervous exercise of a false and hurried intelligence. I needed for God to abandon me before I could feel his presence. I needed to kill someone within me. You've ruined my intelligence with yours, which is that of a genius, and you forced me to know, to know, to know." And she would, yeah, there are so many places she'd just go on like that. And I loved it.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really beautiful. Really beautiful. I thought that it was telling that she really, I think if she was betraying anyone by leaving, it was the dog. Like, she loved Ulysses, and that the dog was named Ulysses was, I thought, also very interesting. But that was who she was going to worry about. I found that incredible. And that also, you know, most people have had pets. Anyone who's ever had a pet, you know, that kind of, the dog loves you unconditionally, and Eduardo was not going to love her because, you know, was not going to show her the kind of affection that she really needed. And it was all about the mind.
Yeah.
And in by being all about the mind, she had to actually step up her sensual existence. She had to keep reminding herself that the world is about not just the mind. The world is about your body and your sensual experiences.
Yeah. She says, "To live, be like my dog, Ulysses. Has nothing in common with Joyce's Ulysses. I tried to read Joyce, but I stopped because he's boring. Sorry, Eduardo. Only he's a boring genius."
Sorry, Eduardo.
But you know, it's funny because you know that she could do that too. I mean, she does it in Hour of the Star, and Ulysses ends with that Leopold Bloom's wife, you know, she's saying, "Yes, yes, I mean, yes, I say yes," at the end of Ulysses, and it ends with a yes. And then the first line of Hour of the Star is, "All the world began with a yes. One molecule said yes to another, and life was born."
Right.
You can tell. I mean, she's read that. She's done that. She's been there, but she's not going to forget about this passion, you know, that's not intellectual.
Yeah. And what a sin it is to actually strip the world of that, to strip your world of that by being of the mind or of the intellect all the time. Killing God before you find him, that kind of thing.
That's right.
It's almost like this intellect knowledge thing, categorization, has this cagey feeling to it. And you never really know exactly what set her off in leaving him. But it's like the life of the body needs to be free in this weird, you know, a spiritual sense. I don't think we ever get at that, the crisis point where she leaves, right? She just goes and complains about how he's a bore, though she loved him.
Yeah, he's a bore and he's boorish.
Right, because for all of his intellect, he didn't understand. I mean, when she had, like, menstrual cramps, he was saying, "Oh, you have a tummy ache, I'm sorry." Yeah. He understood everything, but he didn't understand that.
And he surrounded himself with people who admired him. And, you know, she was expected to be part of that circle of admirers also.
We haven't mentioned the other woman on the train, the older one, very much. I wonder what you thought of her. I mean, in talking, it seems to me that the older woman on the train was an example of a woman who hadn't fled, who was kind of the alternate reality of someone who had stuck with it and not chosen a life of autonomy.
Yeah, and you know, her husband dies, she lives with her daughter, and she has nothing to do. So, you know, she had lived her life for her husband. And then she tries to live her life for her daughter, and her daughter just rejects her.
She's sort of obsessed with putting on airs, too. I mean, she's gotten used to portraying herself in a certain way, the proper way of the old lady that she thinks an old lady is supposed to behave. But inside, she has this rich interior, just like Angela does. And they have that in common. She's sort of bursting at the seams to get out of the traps of the ways she's perceived.
And why was she in the beginning when she wants to look out the window and the young man comes up and says, do you want me to close it or do you want me to open it? Something like that. And she's afraid. She is startled. It's like someone actually sees her and it's startling. And someone wants to do something for her and it's startling. So I found that very interesting too, because I think she's felt invisible for a long time. So it's frightening to have people be aware of you.
I think she goes between playing the role of an old kind lady and struggling with that role, and continually her mentality brings things up like, I'm the richest person on this train and these people don't want to talk to me, and then switching back to this kindly old lady figure. And I think that conflict gets brought up there, how she doesn't know, and maybe that is because her husband's died, now she's neglected, now she's effectively a nobody. She's trying to moor herself to things like, is it a farm that she's going to? Is she being put out to pasture?
Yeah. It's a farm that Angela's going to. I can't remember if it was a farm that Donna was going to as well.
I think Donya's son is a farmer. She says at one point that he's a farmer.
One of the interesting things about the way that that story starts is that, so Donya goes, she gets onto the train, and when it starts to move, she realizes that she's faced herself backwards and is sitting off to the side. And Angela, who's the younger woman, comes up to her and says, would you like to trade places with me? And she's surprised. It seemed to me like there's a little metaphor there that's loaded for you to sort of get on the train of the story. And, you know, it's, what is it to be old, you know, in the way that Donya is old? I mean, what should you have to show for it? She's very self-conscious about being old. And I think that's one of the reasons that she brags about being rich, is that that's one of the things that she can try to have to show for. It's almost like an apologetics of age.
And how about the title, The Departure of the Train? They're both departing. There are interesting things in that. They're both leaving things behind. So do you think that with the backward and forward facing on the train, that Angela's actually going into her life and Donya is receding?
To me, I think that's part of it. So one of the things Cesare was saying, like, Angela is the younger woman. So one of the things that means is that you have the virtue of being able to start over. And she is starting over. Donya can't do that. And she's facing backwards. And it, you know, and what is in front of her is, there's less in front of her. And so what does it mean for her to face forward? Is she better off facing backwards? I don't know. I mean, the train is moving either way.
I think it was tied up in the importance of this train that they were both on, in a certain sense, moving in the same direction. And the decision process, or their conscious effort, has nothing to do where that train's going. The big effort is getting on the train, right? I cannot directly connect it to what we're talking about, but in connecting it to the lighthouse, it's a very much a different metaphor, the train moving on the train, than the lighthouse, and how it's always present, but difficult to get to and requiring of extreme effort. Whereas getting on this train seems to be making a huge effort beforehand, making this, you know, realizing your existential freedom, but then letting the train take you.
Yeah, I think for me, the place where the wolf comparisons were driven home was in the way that she would jump perspectives and just really get into the heads of the different characters and have them be perceiving the same sorts of things, but seeing something entirely different. I mean, is the lighthouse, is that sort of the view from nowhere, the place where perspectives converge, or where you could look out and sort of see things in a 360 kind of way?
To me, that was like a desirous object that was always a possibility, but difficult to achieve within view and incredibly hard to get to. Like, but I mean, to me, the lighthouse and the train kind of function as the same symbol, but the train, once you're on it, once you make that the object of desire, it carries you without further effort, kind of gives you a respite from the freedom that you feel at every other waking moment, whereas the lighthouse was torturous in the sense that it mocked you as begging you to get there, even though certainly it would also fail you. You know, your desires wouldn't be fulfilled in the lighthouse. At the end of the lighthouse, you didn't imagine that that torturous trip there would fulfill anyone's, you know, happiness, or in the sense that I guess this story of the train is left unfinished, in a sense we don't know what happens once they end up at their respective locations, but I can't imagine that they're finding what they're looking for. But right, the trip on the train let them be introspective in a sense.
Yeah, it's interesting because I felt like they were going to places where they knew there was love. And I thought that it was hopeful for both. They were moving themselves out of loveless relationships. And that, you know, that in itself was a really good start. You know, you get yourself out of a bad place, out of a place that's making you unhappy. Whether the new place will make you happy is entirely up to you.
Yeah.
Or whether you find happiness there is entirely up to you, but you do leave what is painful and loveless, or passionless, I should say.
At one point,
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to punctuate what you guys were saying, which is there's a little passage in The Departure of the Dream where she said, I think it's Angela saying, in life, one suffers, but you have something in your hand, ineffable life. But what about the question of death? You had to have no fear to go forward, always, like the train.
Yeah, I thought that was positive. It's positive motion. It's at least moving yourself away from something that was bringing you unhappiness. But what were you saying, Cesare? What did you start to say?
Well, I in a way forgot, but I just want what I was getting to with this whole train metaphor and the continuous movement is that from an existentialist angle, it's kind of the opposite of that, is that you want something in life that you can commit yourself to, that you can take your mind off. And getting on a train is an example of that. You know, she had a 6-month plan to get on this farm. I mean, in my life, for instance, I felt anxious every moment until I decided to take this plunge and do a 2-year school program. And now at least I have 2 years to, you know, hang on in this train and think about all the terrible things that happened in my life before this. But for this 2 years, now that I'm traveling, now I have this plan, I have that respite.
It's interesting.
I think you chose a good train.
Well, there's a part of it too that I think that you really get in a qualitative kind of way reading Le Spectre, that as much as we might strive toward that sort of dependable devotion to a cause or to a feeling or to a person, we're far too chaotic in our interior to be tethered to that. I mean, we might strive for it, but we can't really accomplish it. I think Angela says at one point, coherence is a mutilation. I want disorder. I think she's getting at the fact that a relationship like with Eduardo, you know, or anyone that you may have even wanted and may still want in part of you, but you still can exceed that. You can still be multiple within yourself, and not you can love and then want to be free. You can have intimacy and independence both calling to you at once and be contradictory. I don't know. I mean, you guys, we're probably a little over an hour into it now. The main thing that I would like to get back to at all is the issue of poverty and the hour of the star, because that was one of the interesting things to me about that novel. But if anybody else has anything that we haven't hit yet either, I'd love to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, so much. I mean, I just feel like the Hour of the Star is just incredibly dense and in a good way. I mean, just rich might be a better way of putting it. And there's things that I'm still figuring out and a couple of question passages where I'm not sure what's going on. But yeah, I mean, the poverty is a really good one because I think that there's something, I mean, it's like, again, I think it's heroic on her part. I think it's something that, you know, her character takes on. It's not just that she's, look at this pitiful object. It's really a kind of an exercise in dealing with it. So we can go that route, because I really think that it's a comment on poverty, and especially comments directly to the reader. And it hit me because it's like, well, you're reading this for luxury. Enjoy it. Like, this is wealthy. This is a luxury. This is a privilege to be able to read and not be in this position. I'll lay off there in case anyone else has another way of tying in here. There's so much to say. So,
well, I think the question of her boyfriend confuses things, because if you just take her isolated, Maccabea, then it seems that her poverty curtailed her humanity, in the sense that her inner life, her experiences and her possibilities were impoverished as well with her poverty. I mean, if you look at what she enjoyed, it was listening to radio commercials. And you look at her ways of dealing with things, it was just a by-the-minute type thing. She took a couple days off when she saw that the beautiful man. I think she took a day off at some other point as well. Poverty affected her sense that, I think, limited, I want to say, her humanity or her experiences.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, and like, we've all read it, but I mean, mean, I just think it's worth noting like how profound the poverty was. I mean, we're talking about she would not eat hardly at all. A luxury was cold coffee. One time someone bought her a cup of coffee and it was just the grandest thing that she didn't believe that, you know, she could just get coffee like this.
Well, she had that meal at Gloria's house. She didn't eat like that. It was a banquet.
I don't recall that. I was thinking of the time whenever I think Limbico bought her a cup of coffee and then she wanted creams and stuff in it. And he was like, well, if the cream costs more, then you have to pay for it. And she was like, oh, no, you know, it's a little bit funny, but I'm really tender towards this character. I just think that she's, I mean, really careful. There's a lot of love that the narrator gives to her. It's not like that she's dumb and stupid, even though you could say that about her. Like, even though Olympico's like, why don't you ever say anything? Because getting to that verbal level is a chore. Like, I'm just trying to hang on day to day. I'm not worth anything, I don't feel like. No one's ever told me I'm worth anything. I don't think I deserve anything. I don't think of anything mine because I have nothing. The one day when she took off and she was in the room, she had never had so much space to herself. And, you know, it was joyful.
Just regarding poverty, it's on every level. It's a poverty of spirit also. I want to read a line from page 19. Maybe she thought there was a little bitty glory in living. She thought people had to be happy. So she was. Before her birth, was she an idea? Before her birth, was she dead? And after her birth, she would die? What a thin slice of watermelon.
That was one of mine that I had. Yeah, that's such a great line. What a thin slice of watermelon this is. But it's she holds on to, you know, she doesn't even consider suicide. It's that would be to have agency at all. You know, she just, you know, enjoys whatever moment she has, moment to moment. There's another one. It's this. She says, actually, even the worst childhood is always enchanted. How awful. She never complains just how things are. And who organized the land of men? Surely someday she deserved the heaven of the crooked where you only get in if you're warped.
That's what I think fascinates him so much about her, because he wants her to cry out and just denounce her life and say that this is horrible. I have nothing. I've been shortchanged. This is a terrible fate, you know, for me to end up this way. It's not fair. But she never says that. And it's not how she experiences life at all. And that's what I think is so perplexing about her for him and what he can't get away from. I mean, he talks about how pathetic she is, but at one point he also says, and what if my narrative is sad? Afterwards, I'll surely write something cheerful. Though why cheerful? Because I, too, am a man of hosannas, and someday, perhaps, I'll sing the praises instead of the difficulties of this Northeastern girl. For now, I want to walk naked or in rags. I want to try at least once the lack of taste that they say is in the host. Eating the host will be tasting the flavorlessness of the world and bathing in the know. This will be my courage to abandon old, already comfortable feelings. So that bathing in the know, I mean, I take here him to be referencing the poverty of Christ and that bathing in the know, as opposed to that first line of the novel, the all the world began with a yes. I feel like he's getting at, so what is beneath the experiences of all of these things that we pile on in life? You know, what is beneath, if we strip down all of the experiences of the delicacies, all of the luxuries, and the fact that those are relative to whatever our standard of life is, you know, what we notice. I mean, a cup of hot coffee to me may be something I barely notice at all, but if you haven't had that, then it's a revelation. But he is thinking, he can't comprehend, I think, what it is to experience life in the way that she does, which is to not contextualize everything as the lack of something else. It's just something that's beyond him.
Yeah, there's this bit here that I think really talks about the beauty of it. I forgot to say that it was really alarming that from Maccabeah's almost parched body, so vast was her almost unlimited breath of life, and as rich as that of a pregnant maiden, impregnated by herself, by parthenogenesis. She had schizoid dreams in which giant antediluvian animals appeared, as if she'd lived in the most remote epochs of this bloody earth. I mean, so she has a rich inner life as well, even though it's not composed of something that's thoughtful. And I think that's part of what he's attracted to. I mean, he does see beauty there. It's not just pity.
It's interesting because she's wide-eyed about everything, but doesn't seem to take the time to wonder about most things. And I think that that also is part of the poverty. She doesn't get to do that. And then when she does, it's, you know, a revelation for her and for us.
Yeah, that's what I take take those explosions to be. I think those are explosions of a consciousness expanding. And when they happen, it's sort of a wonderful thing, and it's a tragedy at the same time, because with more comes new experience and new fullness, new consciousness, but it also comes something that now covers over something else, and something that can also be taken away and cause suffering, you know? And it causes desire, and desire can be cruel, because when you don't have the thing that you desire, then you suffer.
Yeah, I was going to say, with a realization comes a lack. If you didn't know you didn't have it, then yeah, you're like, okay.
It's like, I was going to say Prometheus, but I think Pandora's box, right? As soon as she realizes what she's missing, this happens.
Yes, I mean, I think that's a good way to put it, like that, you know, she doesn't know what she's missing, and that's a lot of it. But whenever she, like, we're talking about the fortune teller now, I think, because she has this realization of herself, finally, like she gets a little bit of the luxury of self-reflection, someone else takes her seriously, she has a destiny for the first time, you know, she makes a decision to cut the deck, but at the end, it's not like she feels relieved that there's a specific line where it's that she realizes what it is, and that falling away, or that distinction in her life, was a relief, that it was like a moment where she moved past it and could see things in a different way. It's toward the ending, of course, because the fortune teller's right there at the end. But, you know,
I can read a little bit of that.
Yeah, go, please.
Maccabeus, this is walking out of the fortune teller's right before she's hit by the car. She says, Maccabeus stood a little dizzy, not knowing if she'd crossed the street, since her life had already been changed, and changed by words. We have known since Moses that the word is divine. Even for crossing the street, she was already a different person, a person pregnant with the future. She felt inside her a hope more violent than any despair she had ever felt. If she was no longer herself, that meant a loss that counted as a gain. Just as you can be sentenced to death, the fortune teller had sentenced her to life. Everything was suddenly a lot, and so wide that she felt like crying. I think that gets at what you're saying.
Yeah,
hope can be really cruel. I mean, without it, I mean, it's the greatest cruelty is not having any. Also, it can also be cruel to have it.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's this whole thing about like her being poverty of body and soul. You know, we've talked about that. But like her specific strategy of slowing things down, I think, is a part of that. I think that's, again, going back to the parthenogenesis, she's eating herself slowly. I mean, her stomach's in knots. She ends up vomiting blood at the end, not because of the car accident, I don't think, but because of the ulcer of not eating and drinking a little bit of coffee and waking up with heartburn. She's just like a knot. And, you know, there's that relief at the end of her purging that. And
is there a place where she chewed paper to a pulp?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a strategy.
Woke up in the middle of the night and was so hungry.
I think. And it had something to do with like meat. And if you can't have meat, then the best thing to do is to chew up paper to a pulp and swallow.
But what always gets me throughout this novel about all this is that the experience of suffering that I perceive in all of those things is explicitly not there for her. And so what the question that fascinates me then about that is, so to what extent is that suffering, or to not have hope, a kind of suffering only when you're aware of it? It implicates, I mean, one of the paradoxes of culture, you know, in my life, at least, I think, which is our sort of consumerism. And we have these conflicting values where we say there's something obscene and harmful about this value of acquisition and of getting things and of being attached to things and of needing things to make us happy. But at the same time, there's this harmfulness of poverty where to not have things and to not have the things that we need is, it brings about suffering. But then it's also troubled by the fact that needs change, and it's not always very easy to identify what is a want and what is a need. I guess that's what fascinates me about the questions that I think Lispector's getting at here.
Well, I think whatever you have, we're never satisfied. Those material things, yes, you can definitely be satisfied with dinner. Definitely better to have meat than chew paper. But when you move beyond that, then being satiated makes you want more, except for dinner sometimes.
Yeah, that's explicitly... go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that it's specifically in the novella, they want an inch, take a mile. I think it had something to do with the coffee again, but that came out that, you know, once she got a taste of it, she wanted more. And I mean, not to a greedy extent either, because I mean, I think there's something, it's reasonable that everybody could be fed, you know, that we have, you know, forget about Laszlo's hierarchy or whatever. I mean, you could feed people and have water, like there's a basic level, and she doesn't even have that, right?
I think it went beyond like a simple story of look at this impoverished person who's not materially well off, but look at her richness and how she derives this life in other ways. And I mean, it's shown through both her poverty in other ways and in juxtaposing the other characters who were poor, came from poverty, like her boyfriend, Olympico, who was a murderer, right? And clearly a cruel person. And the fortune teller, who her way of gaining some sort of comfort in life had to involve, you know, prostitution, running a brothel, and then becoming a fortune teller. So it expands the idea of noble poverty into all the ways it's fostered in these characters. Not just that, like, well, clearly, once you give poor people something, they'll just want more, and it really doesn't satisfy their needs because not giving them things doesn't solve problems. Hoping that all these characters are saintly, like Maccabea, doesn't solve the problem because there's your Olympicos and there's your, you know, fortune tellers.
Yeah. And I think there's also a part of it that has to do with knowledge and consciousness. I think we ran into this a little bit when we read some of the Ceron. Clarice Lispector, I think, is worried about consciousness as a cause of suffering in some ways. And that is also something that in some ways, maybe she's envious of Maccabea or created Maccabea to be immune to and to illustrate what it might mean to be immune to the suffering that comes with revelation and consciousness and the troubles of identity, the troubles of being socially conscious, being aware of others. There's a poverty of spirit too that's not material. I think that Maccabea in some ways enjoys the benefits of, but then also is denied.
Yeah, and then there's the idea, when you guys are talking about this, you're making me think about the story of Adam and Eve. When you eat of the tree of knowledge, you bring suffering down upon yourself. You anger the gods by trying to know things, and it brings you suffering.
Yeah, that reminds me of this line that I'm looking at here. Will she ever someday know the swoonings of love? Will she take in her own way the sweet journey? Is this your last line?
No, okay. But it's one of them.
I know nothing. What can you do with the truth that everyone's a little sad and a little alone?
Yeah,
But I think it goes a little deeper with the narrator because they are concerned with the girl and express to us in a way that I can't do anything about it. I guess because they're already dead, but I also think that in the imagination of the narrator, this is something that's imagined to have happened. It's not her, really. Maybe it is, but it seems as though they're saying, I really can't do anything about it. Trust me, if I could, I would do something, but there's no way for me to make an effort. I don't feel satisfied by that. I mean, because you want the photographer to save the girl instead of taking the photo. But yeah, I wonder if that, I mean, but then again, you look around at people who you have not been able to save and the truth of poverty, and it seems wrong to tell the story where you could save them and not be a punch in the stomach to the reader. You know, it's the story of the truth that it doesn't work out or that it has not.
That's right, because a part of this story also is it's an investigation of what it means to write and what it means through writing enter into another kind of subjectivity and bridge your subjectivity with that of a character. Because I think you're right. In many places, it seems as if Maccabea is being sort of created on the fly by Rodrigo, the narrator, and by proxy, Lispector. And it seems like that involves a kind of, there are ways in which that is open to change and contingency, but then there are ways in which to be truthful to the way that things would actually go, you're limited still. And it's by those limits that you do escape your own subjectivity in any sense, if you write, because there are things that are going to ring true and things that aren't going to ring true. And sort of this dialectical exploration that allows you to discover those limits one by one and then find yourself maybe in a new place. And it seems like Rodrigo is, that's what he set out to do through this story. And it's painful to enter into this character, and it's sort of despicable for him, but it's the only way he's going to be able to know life as she experiences it.
Yeah, and at the beginning, in the warming up phase of the back and forth writer voice, there's this idea that I'm going to become this person. It's explicit. You know, I'm going to, by the end of this, have transformed into the other character. And they're trying to find different ways into it, because I think they know that there's the simple story, the fact that a poor girl was hit by a car. That's the story that they've got, and they're trying to find ways to get to that, because it would just be, and they constantly apologize, like, it would be, I could just tell you that, like, that, you know, the ending, I could just tell you, but that's not really the story.
It has to be evoked. It has to come through the words. Thinking is an act. Feeling is a fact. It's running all through the novel that, you know, there are facts and there are facts. And, you know, he's just going to tell the facts. But he's already told you that a feeling is a fact and a thought is an act. So that means that, you know, all of this stuff that's happening in his mind, it's objective and subjective. It's happening and it's not. It's determined and it's free.
And also a word is an action, I think, yes, is one of those. So that whenever you've got this journey into the story, at the beginning, the narrator is waffling on it. Is this something worth telling? Or in the second, after they have a night, they need a couple of days to rest and then come back to it. They have this back and forth again of like, is this something that I should keep telling? No, I'm going to persevere. I'm going to, you know, go through it. Almost like, is it worth writing at all? Or what does it mean to bring this person into the world and do this to them? But I think that they're trying to be an open eye. And at one point, I get that they're feeling that they have to express this, that they have this love for this person and it's a loss and they want to communicate this as best they can. And they say that, I told you it was a cheap tearjerker, but I'm not going to show any mercy. You know what I mean? Like, so I realize that this is, you know, a simple thing, but I'll be damned if it's not true and I feel it. Like, you're going to feel it, you know, if you stick around. The whole life is a punch in the stomach again.
True, a word's never spoken.
It's got like, 14 different titles, this book. The number 7 seems to be a thing for her. I'm not sure why, but I think in The Departure of the Train, Doña is 77, Angela is 37, Doña has 7 names, preceding facts, cheap tearjerker, discreet exit through the back door.
Wow. I missed that. Like, I didn't see the titles.
I was reading one of the things that Laura posted. Hello, Laura. We love you. And sorry you can't be here right now because of tech. But, you know, just about how whenever people find them, they like latch on to the, you know, it's one of those authors that, you know, are a surprise and a joy to discover and learn more of. I had another line. I think it might be the titular bit of The Hour of the Star. It's not titular exactly, but I think it's the zone. The girl didn't wonder why she was always being punished, but you don't have to know everything. And not knowing was an important part of her life. That not knowing might seem awful, but it's not that bad because she knew lots of things in the way nobody teaches a dog to wag his tail or a person to feel hungry. You're born and you just know, just as nobody one day would teach her how to die. Yet she'd surely die one day. And if she'd learned the starring role by heart, for at that hour of death, a person becomes a shining movie star. It's everyone's moment of glory, and it's when, as in choral chanting, you hear the whooshing shrieks. I'm thinking about the whooshing shrieks and the choral chanting. That throws me. I can see this death moment that she's setting up, and that everybody, it's the part you were born to play.
her 15 minutes of fame where she's finally noticed, right?
Yeah. Well, I think it's also just like, it's such a personal thing. It's just the fact of life. And in that way, there's no avoiding it, and that it's something that you just will go through, and everybody just will go through it. And so it's this kind of a role or this kind of function. You don't have to know about it.
You play your part perfectly, right?
Yeah, it's everyone's moment of glory. I think that's the, you know, the hour of the star is her death there. And I'm interested to hear your thing about explosions. I want to go back to that because I think that it can serve that way. But it seems like maybe there's a metatextual thing going on or an extra textual thing that I just don't get.
I want to mention before that last thought on the death kind of forces people to accept her previous existence in a sense that where she was an invisible person going through life, no one noticing her death, not in her case only, but in everyone's case, kind of feels uneasy because you have to acknowledge an existence that you adhere to for or not done, right?
I hadn't thought of it that way, but it makes a lot of sense out of things. Because she kind of hinted at the end there that in some ways that was the fortune that she'd been given coming true. Or she at least kind of says, you know, I won't say, I'm saying she is in Lispector, but I guess it's he is in Rodrigo. He says, I won't say, you know, that it didn't happen, that she didn't get this fortune, because she was hit by a Mercedes, which is a rich kind of car. And he won't say that the beautiful blonde guy who was walking by didn't then look at her when it happened. And so he flirts with this idea that she did kind of get that 15 minutes of fame there.
Yeah, I was just going to add that I think that it was a positive experience for her. Even whenever she was hit and flying through the air, I think that she was saying that, you know, she was appreciating things or seeing things. Yeah, it was this moment of change or a moment of departure. I'm not trying to make a connection there with the other story, but it was this moment of all happened right there at that moment. I think that, you know, she didn't even consider her own death really, or her own life. You know, she didn't really think much of it. And it's, I mean, she got cut down right in the middle of it, but it wasn't like an agony, I don't think. I think that would be a story, but I don't think that's this story, that she was grasping at the hope that she had just got. It was almost like this was a continuation of the hope that this was the future that she was being promised. She also had that feeling, she had the little thrill whenever she saw a soldier and thought that a soldier might kill her. It was this contact with mortality, I think.
Well, something's definitely happening.
Yeah, I just keep coming back to the fact that, I keep coming back to the idea that she's encapsulating the contradictions within a single phenomenon. It was an expansion, or it was a change getting hit, but it was brought in new sensations, new awarenesses that were in some ways beneficial. And then she brought in other ones, you know, or the same ones that were suffering and that were painful. And for me, it got it the way that life is both of those things. Life brings in events that are, you know, we can't nail down as being one specific category. We can't nail down as experience as having only certain qualities that are mutually exclusive with other qualities, and that in the final verdict have to either be one or the other.
Should we do last lines? You got a favorite line, Cesare?
Can I do one from The Departure of the Train?
Do one from wherever you want.
Thank you.
True freedom.
This is, I think it's a longer paragraph, and it's more her complaining about Eduardo. I have a bad side. It is the stronger, and it prevailed, although I tried to hide it because of you. On the strong side, I'm a cow. I'm a mare running free who paws the ground. I'm a woman of the streets. I'm a slut, and not a woman of letters. I know that I am intelligent, and that sometimes I hide it in order not to offend others with my intelligence. I, who am of the subconscious. I fled from you, Eduardo, because you were killing me with your genius, intellect that practically forced me to cover my ears with my hands and scream out in horror and exhaustion. And now I will remain 6 months on the farm. You don't know where I'll be, and every day I'll bathe in the river, mixing its clay, my own blessed mud. I am vulgar, Eduardo. I want you to know that I like to read true romance magazines, my love. Oh, my love, how I love you, and how I love your terrifying spells. Ah, how I adore you, your slave, slave that I am. But I am physical, my love. I am physical, and I had to hide from you the glory of being physical. And you, who are the very splendor of rational thought, though you don't know it, you were nourished by me. You, super intellectual and brilliant.
I dedicated to the memory of my former poverty when everything was more sober and dignified and I had never eaten lobster. I dedicated to the Tempest of Beethoven, to the vibrations of the neutral colors of Bach, to Chopin, who makes me swoon, to Stravinsky, who frightened me and with whom I soared in fire. And then she just goes on and on and on.
It was really beautiful, though.
Yeah, I was trying to make notes whenever something hit, and then I would just keep going and just keep. It was hard to find discrete moments. It was just, just such a flow.
Mine is from Aravistar, and this is another thing that Eduardo says parenthetically about her. She makes me so uncomfortable that I feel hollow. I'm hollow of that girl. And the more uncomfortable she makes me, the less she demands. I'm angry. So enraged I could smash cups and dishes and break windows. How can I avenge myself? Or rather, how can I make up for it? I've got it. By loving my dog who has more food than that girl. Why doesn't she react? Can't she grow a backbone? No, she is sweet and obedient.
One of his many asides.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the asides.
Yeah, mine is an aside too. If the reader possesses any wealth and a comfortable life, he'll step out of himself to see how the other sometimes lives. If he's poor, he won't be reading me, because reading me is superfluous for anyone who has a slight permanent hunger. Here I'm playing the role of a safety valve for you and from the massacring life of the average middle class. I'm well aware that it's frightening to step out of oneself, but everything new is frightening. Though the anonymous girl in this story is so ancient that she could be a biblical figure, she was subterranean and had never flowered. I'm lying. She was grass.
Well, thanks for reading this one with me, guys. I enjoyed the chance to talk about it.
Yeah, thanks for suggesting it.
Yeah, it's an incredible surprise. I've never heard of this author. Mattingly brilliant.